Welcome, friends, to the TRP Weekly Podcast. TRP, if you don't know, is a progressive cooperative Baptist church in Salisbury, Maryland. And in this podcast, we will normally try to do two things. First, following our typical routine on Sundays, we want to have a conversation about a lectionary passage. We do that because that's what we do on Sundays. We have conversations, we sort of have ditched the monologue scripted sermons, and instead we gather people together in a room, we kick around ideas, and because we don't want to record those conversations, we gather brilliant minds here in Tessa Stultz's kitchen to kick around some ideas about the Bible. The second thing we want to do is we want these recorded conversations about the Bible to provide parents with some additional helps for their own conversations with their kids, who are going to be learning about the very same texts on Sundays in TRP's kids ministry. I'm Josh, I'm one of the pastors, and today I am joined yet again by the inestimable, we're all kind of looking around saying, is that a word? I think so, maybe. By the highly esteemed Laura and Chris.
Hello.
This is another podcast that doesn't really fit the normal conscriptions of what we're trying to do because we're not actually going to talk about this text on Sunday morning at all. Instead, we have a budget meeting coming up. So we have designated our entire Sunday to discussing the budget and talking about TRP's finances and what we're attempting to do in the world. But this text, folks, this text is so juicy and so beautiful that I did not want it to go undiscussed. So today we will be talking about the very well-known and not at all problematic creation story of Genesis chapter 1. Chris, Laura, tell me your experiences with this story, your background, what you know, what you don't know, where you come from, what you've heard.
Okay. So my background is I grew up in church. I went to a Christian private school. And so my experience with this would be as a kid taught the 7-day creation story as it's listed out there in Genesis. And it was just sort of a matter of fact. This is the way things are. I think later on in my private Christian school experience, I was exposed to probably some individuals who were more aggressively creationist. If I don't know if I'm spoiling anything here. But
what a private Christian school was talking about creationist science.
I remember in one chapel in particular there being this wonderful illustration about a pen somehow floating through space and all the pieces of a pen and how improbable it would be that those pieces would come together. And
it's like when Ray Comfort has that Coke can and says that it all just happened by chance.
Right.
And he starts to talk about how some paint was floating through space. They're always
right.
in space.
Right.
And some paint was floating in space and spells out Coca-Cola Classic.
Right.
And then he goes on to say, original formula.
Right.
Like I just had to tack that on.
That was probably the inspiration for
this.
There you go. And there was a pen nearby, so they took apart the pen and then said how improbable it would be that these parts would just somehow fall together. So, you know, I don't think it was beat into me, so to speak, but it was definitely the backstory of my upbringing was a literal 7-day creation sort of.
I think another way to frame that too might be anti-evolution.
Yeah, very much so, right? Mm-hmm. It's a pushback against modern evolutionary theory sort of thing. Yeah.
And even that word theory might be used as a
derogatory
way to, right?
Yeah.
Which would be the non-scientific way of using the word theory. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Laura, what about you?
Similar. I also went to a small Christian school. Vastly superior to the one down the road.
Not in sport.
Absolutely in sports. It may have shifted after my graduation, but while I was still there, Chris.
That's for another podcast.
Anyway, so I, same, very evangelical, literal translation of the Genesis story.
Can we pause here for a second and at least note that when we're talking about the Genesis creation story, we would be more right to say the Genesis creation stories, plural. You've got right. Genesis 1, it's really 1-1 through 2-4-A, and then 2-4-B, and the whole Adam and Eve creation story and the Garden of Eden.
Sure.
But never taught that way.
No.
That there were two stories.
No.
Right? It's one singular.
But then you read it and wonder, how did I miss that these are two very separate situations?
Yeah.
Say more about that without getting us too far off
track. It's almost like they're written by completely different people for completely different purposes.
Okay. Do you have like different a for themes. Instance there?
Fact, narrative.
Okay. I'd push back on fact. Maybe
it just seems a little bit more bullet pointy.
Structured.
Yes.
Okay. So if you're just going to talk about like literary style, one is very ordered and one is very artsy.
Yes.
And even the depiction of God in Genesis 1, which is the story of like the different days of creation, God is sort of like transcendent, above it all, you know, calling things into existence, shaping, moving, sort of working at an ethereal level, whereas in Genesis 2, he's like fashioning the dust of the earth into a human and then breathing into its nostrils the breath of life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like God is very
sudden,
imminent, right?
Yeah, he's got
really
a lot
involved.
More interested. Yeah.
Yeah. So just looking at the different, the literary aspects of the two stories would make you say, yeah, these feel really different. If you dig into more of the specifics, you start to see things that kind of
butt heads
a bit. Yeah. Conflict, things that can't go together, especially if you're reading the New Revised Standard Version, which we would never have done that.
Maybe the New King James if we're feeling spicy. So I didn't come to really put any thought at all into Genesis until I went K-12 at that Christian school, and then I went to the University of Delaware for 2 years. And I took an ecology class, just a 100 or 200 level ecology class, and learned very specific examples of natural selection.
Did anyone warn you prior to your attendance that your faith would be tested?
Yes, of course, multiple times. But I was riveted by that class. It made sense. It didn't ask anything of me other than just to look at data. I feel like it was almost like a light bulb moment of, this is what I've been missing all this time as far as a logical progression of events in nature. And so I wasn't asking a lot of hard questions and not getting answers. I didn't know to ask the questions until I started learning this stuff. And so for a bit, it felt a little scary, like, oh, this is not good. Natural selection is part of what you hear about when you talk about Darwinist theories. But it just is. And so it sort of opened a door to me, certainly not to reject the Bible or Genesis, but to think, there's a lot more here than what's written in the beginning parts of Genesis, and I need to not reject it all out of hand.
To be fair, a lot of times, even non-Christians will pit science against the Bible.
And it doesn't.
Sort of assuming that like the correct way to read Genesis 1 is as literal, factual, historical, and must therefore be wrong and incompatible on that ground, which has always been, well, now in hindsight, it's been weird for me to see that, because that's not at all what Genesis 1, or I would say Genesis 2 and 3, is attempting to do.
And it never asked it of us, I don't think. I feel like it was asked of us by those well-meaning people that taught us in elementary and high school. But I don't think the Bible or its authors were asking it of us.
Especially when you consider how many different creation stories there are in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
It's not just Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and 3. There's all sorts of like poetic texts. Like Job talks a lot about these things. Proverbs 8 talks about these things. There's some Psalms that refer to the creative activities of God, and they always do so in very different ways and oftentimes very mythic ways that can't really stand with Genesis 1 or Genesis 2 and 3. There's contradictions all over the place, and yet we privilege this one or two stories. Usually the way that it was framed to me was, well, Genesis 1 gives you the big picture, and then Genesis 2 and 3 sort of zooms in the microscope, and then you just start looking at these characters, but they don't really go together. It doesn't make sense. Chris, you had a thought, I think.
I was going to ask Laura, in that college course, because I had a similar experience in a college biology course. When you first started getting that information, did you need to figure out how to make them work together?
Yes. I felt compelled to justify it against what I had been taught.
Yeah.
And so if these instances of moths with smoke up against tree bark
are a very specific example,
are actual science, and I believe them to be, how do I square that with God as creator and mm-hmm. things not needing to evolve from what they are to stay alive and thrive?
And there are whole organizations that are devoted to doing just that.
When I think the more beautiful way to look at it is, these species can adapt to survive and thrive. Isn't that genius?
I remember it was at our 10-year high school reunion. So, I mean, I'm 28 or so at this point in life. And I remember talking to someone who had attended a Christian college that was a really good Christian college and been through all of the same sort of courses that, Laura, that you were getting. I went to Bible college, so we didn't get any of this. I've never had a proper science class my entire life, I don't believe. But they were saying, isn't it cool to think about how God has overseen billions of years of slow evolutionary change?
And your brain exploded.
My brain, it absolutely exploded. I was thinking like, yeah, that's way better than this picture I've had of God just sort of snapping God's fingers and things coming into being and this earth being super young. You know, like it was a different way of thinking about it that sort of made my lights go on. Because at this point in life, you know, I was a Bible guy, and I didn't really have a dog in this fight. I didn't really care. I just wanted to figure out what the text was saying and what was going on and what its theology was. But that was a really meaningful moment in my life that sort of sent me down the trail of beginning to read books. I mean, like Richard Dawkins type books, scientific type books at a popular level, and trying to figure out what evolutionary science was even all about and how that might mm-hmm. be. I don't want to say how that might be squared with the Bible, because I don't think that was the point for me back then, but how that might go with my belief system, which Richard Dawkins would hate, but you know, like
right.
blending those two ideas and almost sort of being guided by this idea of like, yeah, God is invested and involved in some meaningful way over all of this. Isn't that pretty cool and powerful?
Yeah. And it's, in my mind, better.
Yeah.
More beautiful, more meaningful.
People are going to struggle with that, though, I'm sure. Maybe not anybody who's listening to this podcast, but why do you think some people would really wrestle with that concept of scientific stuff being a better depiction?
Because anytime you threaten the Bible is literal, people question, well, does that mean all of it's garbage? And have I spent my whole life following nothing?
I feel like the three of us have had this conversation at this table before.
It's just scary for people. And it you know, it need not be, but it is at first.
All right. So tell me about creation now. Are you an evolutionist? Go.
So what's the joke about, you know, a long time ago, an ancestor walked out of the ocean, and now I got to go to work every day. So I'm a con on evolution. You know, okay. So here, you ready for the thesis? Here's my background on this creation, evolution, the whole piece. I don't have an answer, except what I do have is it's a really big universe, so big that I can't even wrap my head around how big it is. The scale of both the universe in size and then also the scale of the really, really small is too hard for us to wrap our heads around even. And so I've sort of made the decision that my God has to be at least that big, which means that I also can't wrap my head around that God or around this process. And so in that, anytime I try to describe God, it's going to be less than perfect because I can't wrap my head around it. And so then when I look back at a creation story, I kind of put it in that same context that I can't wrap my head around this God. These creation stories were doing the best to depict a God, a story of a God, and give us a piece of that puzzle, but they don't give us the whole thing. So that's first principle. The second principle would be the creator of the universe. And I'm going to use that sort of just broadly because I don't have the answers for that. Also gave us these brains and gave us the ability to reason and think and observe. And from that, we have science and we have these observations. And so to reject this whole set of observations, this wondrous thing that we've been given, this intelligence that we've been given, to sort of reject that. I mean, so part of the things that started making, you know, sort of a young Earth creation fall apart for me was, gosh, just walking through caverns, like the Ray Caverns over in the Shenandoah Valley and going, wait a second, 6,000 years. Like I can conceive of 6,000 years or whatever that number would be. I can't conceive of how that massive structure of stone was formed in that amount of time. Just doesn't make sense. Or the Grand Canyon or any of those things. And it's kind of like, wait, some of this stuff doesn't make sense. This stuff over here, like Laura said, this stuff actually really does make a whole lot of sense. And so evolution, yeah, sure. Because I'm not trying to hold on to something that I think is incompatible with that. I think the God of the universe has to be big enough to be able to hold all of those things.
There's a lot there. I want to unpack some of it, but we'll go to Laura next, though. Evolutionist, yes or no?
That was
the question, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well done. I would say, yeah, in that the only thing I'm tethered to is God as creator, because I'm not a scientist. And to be fair to this conversation, I have not taken a deep dive into any of this. But I don't think it takes anything away from God. In fact, I think it lends more to his amazing nature to look at creation as something that's happened over time, like you were talking about the conversation at the reunion. Number one, it makes more sense to me on a logical level. I can remember being in a middle school, I think, and looking at a map of the world and noticing how the continents fit together exactly as one big landmass and thinking.
My 9-year-old at this point would be like, yeah, Pangea.
Yeah.
Duh. And like, I'm just thinking about the education that he's getting as opposed to what I was getting.
Yes.
Like, oh my
and
gosh.
I said something. I can't for the life of me remember what teacher it was, which is probably good.
Well, I know who we had in sixth grade.
But I remember saying, these look like they fit together and just broke apart at some point. And I have a theory about how that happened, but you know, it's obvious in several locations how well the landmass.
What'd they
fit.
Say?
That's not, no.
Couldn't have happened in 6,000 years.
No. And so I remember, you know, I went back to that moment several times and throughout my education and in my adult life and thought, what would that have cost God? Nothing for it to have, if for a Christian to admit that it was one big landmass that broke apart. What are we doing?
It would have cost that particular teacher a lot. And like, I'm going back to what you were saying, Chris, about like our minds and our brains and whatever. And for some people, this is just not an issue that they care about at any level.
Yeah.
I'm thinking particularly about some people that I love very dearly who, whenever I have these conversations about this sort of stuff, it's just, they're kind of like, meh, whatever. I don't really care.
Yeah.
So they might continue to read the Bible through a literal lens and be fine with it not being the most scientifically advanced understanding of the world. And I guess I want to make space for that. The more excited I get about ideas, I love to talk about them, but I also don't want to posture as though I have it all figured out and I must enforce my opinions on you. Because like you said, I'm not a scientist. Mm-mm. At all. Like,
and I don't need
Bible
Genesis
college
to be,
degree yeah. here.
I don't need Genesis to be a source of science for me.
Now that's where I will go pretty hard and say Genesis is not, definitely not intending to be a scientific mm-hmm. textbook. And when you read it in its historical context, you begin to see that. So like that's a conversation I'm very willing to have, and also not trying to throw that upon people. But if anything that I've learned or gained through education, books, research, whatever, if that's beneficial, I'll lay it out to folks. But there's that weird sort of, I don't know. They some people just don't want to go there and can't go there, and I don't always know what to do with that, but I try to leave space for it, I guess.
Can we acknowledge, though, that there's space here to hold both things, to hold the creation stories sacred?
Yes, good.
Absolutely.
Because I think, and you even mentioned Richard Dawkins, I think, so there's error is not the right word here, but there's sort of two camps that we could fall into mm-hmm. where it's the creation story is literal, and therefore everything that anyone tells you about evolution is therefore wrong.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of also the error that I would see on the Richard Dawkins side, which is this is the whole source of truth over here in evolution, and if you believe in God, therefore you are wrong.
Like, yeah.
I think both groups draw conclusions that are way beyond the amount of information that they have available to them. And I think that there is a place that we can live in the middle where we don't have to read the creation story as little. We can read it as a beautiful creation story and draw the meaning from it and still also acknowledge, hey, evolution, yeah, that's okay. And we don't have all the answers because we can't. We can live
in
that.
And I think you can also read the creation story and get a very clear picture of God's intent for humanity. Yeah. Even if you don't have a play-by-play for how it was done.
I might add, if you're reading it in its historical context.
Are we going to go there?
I want to. Well, I mean, part of me doesn't even like saying that because I do believe that you can sit down with the text and gain something meaningful from mm-hmm. it. But when you don't understand the entire background to Genesis 1, you're going to miss some really juicy theological tidbits.
Can we talk about here. The vault?
You know, we're not going to talk about the vault because the text that we have in the lectionary for this week is Genesis 1, 1 through 5. So it doesn't get us as far as the rakia or the expanse or the firmament in the sky that's separating the waters that are above and the waters that are below.
The most advanced science they had in their day.
Which was often the science of observation, seeing what the world mm-hmm. was as they understood it and as they looked around and saw it. And then they made some story. I was going to say they made up some stuff to try to explain what it was, but I know that's not going to land real well with a lot of people who might hold to a grander view of inspiration where the mm-hmm. Holy Spirit sure. is talking to these individual authors of the text. But even in that, there's just a lot of problems that come along with that. Before we get into the text, though, just a word about this background. Everything changed for our reading of Genesis 1 in the mid-19th century. For the most of interpretive history, people sort of read the Bible at face value and thought that it was historical. And then the Enlightenment happened and people started asking big questions. In the mid-19th century, we add on to that matrix archaeology and many important archaeological finds. For example, in the mid-19th century, archaeologists discovered thousands of clay tablets in the library of King Ashurbanipal, which is in ancient Nineveh. I believe that's modern-day Iraq. Ashurbanipal was in the 6th century BCE, and when these tablets were translated, things got really weird. They're written in a language called Akkadian. They got so weird, in fact, that Pete Enns says it's not an overstatement to say that how people viewed the Bible would never be the same again. Because in a nutshell, a lot of the religious material for ancient Assyrian and Babylonian peoples, they sounded really, really, really scarily familiar to what is contained in the Hebrew Bible. For example, one of the Babylonian creation stories, there's a handful of them, but probably the most famous is called Enuma Elish. Some other folks might refer to it as When on High. Enuma Elish is the Akkadian phrase which means When on High, which is the first words of this particular story. Fun fact, this is how a lot of the biblical texts are named as well. It's the first word of the story, so Genesis is known as Bereshit. So Enuma Elish, it includes the following similarities to the Genesis account. Things like the sequence of the days of creation, which includes the creation of the firmament or the expanse or that rakia. So that's in the early verses of Genesis to separate the waters from above and the waters from below. This also happens in Enuma Elish. There's a little difference, though, because Marduk, who is one of the gods in this story, defeats Tiamat, a water goddess, and fillets her body into two, and with one half of her body, he creates the firmament in the sky, which keeps the waters above out of the land below. With the other half of her body, he creates the dry land. So we've got this sequence of days with the creation of the firmament and the expanse and the dry land, also the sun and the moon and the stars, and then humanity. This all happens in Genesis and Enuma Elish. There's also darkness that precedes the creative activity in both of these stories. There's a division of the waters, as we've already talked about, waters above, waters below. Light exists before the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars. So you might not, if you sat down to read Enuma Elish, you might not say, ah, that's Genesis, but you're certainly going to get to a handful of lines where you say to yourself, I've heard this before. I think that these similarities really come through when you're talking about the flood narrative. Mm. When you compare the story of Noah to other ancient Near Eastern stories of an individual surviving a flood, they're really hard to silence some of those very clear connection, so much so that when these texts were first translated, people began to absolutely freak out and think that the Bible was just a bunch of hooey and everyone was making up stuff. So we can just pause right there and say, how do we feel at this point knowing, and I'm looking across the table and thinking, well, this is a stupid question because I know both of you and I know where you're coming from and I know that you don't care or that you think that this stuff is really cool, but pretend that this is, you're a freshman in your introduction to the Bible course and this is some of the new information that's being presented to you and you're fresh out of your private Christian school education. What does this information now do to you and how you view the Bible, and how you view God, and how you view creation?
That's really scary. It threatens your foundation because it's like, oh, everybody knows the same events happened to the earth and they just attributed it to their God.
Is it worth asking why we're so hell-bent on creating this foundation?
Maybe.
That we know is, this is not privileged information. Mm-hmm. This is in literally every freshman class, which is why when you go to those schools, they warn you not to take these courses, or when you do, to stand firm in your, they know this exists. Why can't we just adjust the foundation to include some of this material to help us understand what the text actually is?
I think we can, but I think what's natural for us is sort of to do the thing where we decide that we do have it all figured out, right? There's some, you said it was scary, right? So there's some stability in the idea that we've got it figured out. So this kind of story comes up, and I think you got to do one or two things with it. You've either got to decide, like evolutionary theory maybe that you were presented at some point, you either have to decide that everybody's lying or that they don't know what they're talking about, or in this case, it's either fake or it's an incomplete picture that those people had, and now we've got the real picture right here in our version of this. Because we could do that. We could manipulate this, and we could say, yeah, that's what they thought. But then here was the real inspiration that came in Genesis that gave us the true picture of what happened. And again, I think we're on that side where it's pretty natural to want to be in the camp that has it figured out, that has the answers. And suddenly when you don't have those answers anymore, when your source of truth kind of looks like everybody else's, or it's a little bit muddy now, that's the scary part.
Which is actually that last line. That's the key to understanding this thing.
Right.
Your story looks like other stories in this larger cultural context. Like as again, Pete Enns would say, these authors are breathing the same air, telling stories that look really similar with noticeable differences. Like we outlined all of the similarities, but there's noticeable differences. For example, in Genesis, we don't have God filleting another god and using one half of their body to create a rakia in the sky to keep the waters above separate from the waters below. Right, there is no violence in Genesis 1. That's a very noticeable difference that says a lot about the Israelite creation story that we would not know or perceive if we weren't exposed to these other ancient pictures of creation to see how they're contrasting, to see how Genesis might be functioning as a polemic against some of these other stories. And that's not to say that the author of Genesis sat down with Enuma Elish opened up on one side of the desk and then wrote down trying to course. But there's just all of these ideas are just kind of floating around in the ether, and they're commenting on how their God might be different than the God who is present in the very same cultural context when Genesis 1 was probably put together. So most scholars would say that Genesis 1 is finalized, at least in the time of the Babylonian exile. In other words, in a cultural milieu where Babylonian creation accounts were known and existed, and there would be some play between the two.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, ups the ante for concepts like inspiration and inerrancy and whatever sort of words we want to attach to the Bible. Seeing it working in its historical moment makes it more special. It's like that same thing where, you know, the guy was saying, isn't it cool to see God overseeing billions of years of evolutionary change? It's also cool to see how God might be working through the author's pen of a people in a very historically rooted moment in time to give them something to think about that stands in contrast to what is surrounding them.
Yeah, to the other violent narratives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've got here the New Revised Standard Version, updated edition.
2021.
Of Genesis 1 through 5.
And I love this version.
I'll be honest, like, I haven't spent a lot of time with this version yet. It just came out a couple years ago. And it was almost like there's translations in the Hebrew Bible especially that are just, you don't touch them. You can't change them. They are what they are, even though every translator on every translation committee knows that this is a bad translation of this text. But they're so embedded in American cultures of faith that you can't alter them without
A riot
ensuing.
Yeah.
And in these first few verses, you start to see some of those changes actually being made because the NRSV update edition don't give a damn who they're upsetting, apparently. Yeah. So this is how it is. I'm going to read through it, and then I'd love to hear you guys talk about the translation decisions that stand out to you that are different from, you know, the normal NIV or whatever else it is that you may have grown up with. It says this: when God began to create the heavens and the earth was complete chaos, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Do you want me to read the NIV for comparison's sake?
Yeah, that would be cool.
Okay, so here's the NIV. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening, and there was morning, the first day. It's really, most of the substantial stuff is just coming in those right first two verses. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I was immediately struck by the absence of "in the beginning."
Yeah.
When God began to create.
So that begs the question, like, so how long was he around before that? Or, like, how long did he wait? What?
That question should still be present regardless of translation, I think, but this definitely does paint a different picture.
Well, in the beginning is, okay, this is the starting point. This is sort of like, assumes God's there, and like you said, now he's getting started with now, this whole creation thing.
In Genesis 1, what is not created?
The heavens and the earth. Wait, God.
So by the end of Genesis 1, what's not stated as something that's been created?
People.
Or animals. Adam and Eve.
Well, they show up at the very end.
Foliage.
Do they? That's right.
I mean, it's just water and the sky and the moon and sun.
You're not talking about these verses.
Angels.
You're talking about. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Other deities.
Fair.
Lesser deities, that sort of thing. Yeah. Like, nowhere. But if you have this, when God began to create, and you're thinking about this stuff and who God may or may not be hanging out with, there's nothing stated in this text about when they show up. Unless you wanted to say that the stars are some kind of play on that, have to do with divine beings, but that seems like a bit of a stretch.
Verse 2 is interesting, too.
Big time.
The earth was complete chaos.
Right, so that's a translation of the Hebrew tohu vavohu, formless and void, formless and empty. It's a weird translation, too, because the way that chapter 1 works out, it's very structured, where in days 1 through 3, God is forming, and in days 4 through 6, God is filling. So it almost works out very poetically. Like the way that we talk about Genesis 1, it's very ordered, it's very structured. It's also very poetic. There's a lot of, there was evening, there was morning. It's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of stuff that's happening. It's also very structured in the sense of days 1 through 3 mirror days 4 through 6 in that days 4 through 6 fill the spaces that have been formed in days 1 through 3. And when you take away formless and void and turn it into this one phrase, complete chaos, you lose that. But one of the benefits of talking about chaos is because it's tipping its cap to ancient Near Eastern parallel creation accounts where this chaotic, watery mess is embedded within those creation stories. Tiamat, for example, is a water goddess. Some people even think that that name Tiamat goes with the Hebrew word tahom, which means the deep. It's this watery mass. And some people see a play on that. So it seems like the translators are wanting you to bring those ideas together. The earth was complete chaos. That's the problem. And God is about to form and fashion the world and separate things to make it organized and habitable.
I love that.
Excellent. Thank you.
I love the use of the word, the words complete chaos, because
God is about to order.
Yeah, it's also like the play on tohu vavohu. Like you can just hear it. It goes. So some translators might say things like wild and waste. They want it to have some sort of assonance or alliteration or some sort of flow. It's really hard to create an English translation that does justice to the literary plays on words in the Hebrew, but there might be a piece of that too, like complete chaos. Also, the only other times that tohu vavohu shows up in the Hebrew Bible, it's after a destruction has taken place. So for an exilic people reading this story and hearing about the God of creation who sees the earth as completely chaotic, things have been destroyed. Well, yeah, stuff was just destroyed in Jerusalem when the town was completely taken over and the temple was destroyed. So for a people living in a foreign land would hear about the creative activities of God organizing, might be able to put faith in a God like that to organize and structure the world again for them. But you get here, we're back into it. That's cooler than a God who just snaps God's fingers and creates stuff. Who cares? That's not as cool as the meaningfulness of what this story might, how it might mean for people that hear it originally. The earth was complete chaos. What else sticks out? There's one huge one here for me.
I don't know if this is it, but instead of the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the water, it's a wind from God swept over.
Yeah, so that Hebrew word ruach can mean breath, wind, spirit. When you hear the Spirit of God hovering, what do you think?
Like literally God in a body, like kind of, I don't know.
Even though the
on a hoverboard from Back to the Future.
Sorry. The verb's probably getting in the way. What do you think when you hear Spirit of God?
I know that the Holy Spirit hasn't been introduced yet, but I go.
You
there.
Go Trinitarian.
Yes, absolutely.
This is a different entity hovering over on their hoverboard that they just got for Christmas, like over the waters. But now the translator's decision to say, let's not go Spirit here. Maybe
wind.
Because we're trying to avoid some Trinitarian language. Instead, let's go wind here. Now, again, think about ancient Near Eastern context. How does Marduk kill Tiamat? He throws a big fat wind in her face and gets her jaw to open up so he can split her right down the middle. So now we have the wind of Marduk that's deathly versus a wind from God that's sweeping. Some commentators have said this is a really positive way of saying this. I don't think we get this. This doesn't come off the page, but like a wind from God sweeping over the face of the waters. I don't know if you go to the beach and there's this little gentle breeze. It's nice. I think that's kind of what's happening here. Mm-hmm. So it's like this contrast between the violent wind that leads to the death of a goddess versus the wind.
A peaceful, thoughtful situation.
Yeah.
Also, a little bit of maybe control is not the right word, but in contrast to the chaos there.
Yes.
Over.
I've often preached this as, especially because you have here, the darkness was covering the face of the deep. That's the word tohom here, which is a loaded mythical word. Because in the ancient mindset, the deep or even the waters were unknown, uncharted territory, scary, chaotic, not to be messed with, and God's wind sweeping over the face of the waters, keeping the waters at bay, as if to say, I'm in control here, and you can't go where I don't allow you to go.
That's beautiful imagery, and I would imagine a great source of comfort.
Again, for an exilic people.
Yes. Yes.
Now, that's not to say that this story was created out of whole cloth in the aftermath of the Babylonian exile. Nor was Enuma Elish actually predates Genesis on nearly every account. So that story was known before the Genesis story, but as Genesis was being pieced together in its final form, a lot of this Babylonian context certainly comes into play here. Anything in that last bit, and here we're not dealing with noticeable differences, but the whole let there be light and there was light and God saw that light was good, any of that like striking you as theologically significant?
Well, you know, just the sense of, okay, so we got chaos and we have darkness, which I think we can relate to. I mean,
yeah,
life being what life is, chaos and darkness are things that we can relate to. And then you have a God that speaks light into that chaos and darkness, yeah, and light being the thing that sets it off, having that power over the darkness, having the power over the chaos. That's one of my favorite phrases, let there be light. If I do get another tattoo, it will be that.
Don't get it in Hebrew.
Negative. Okay. It was going to be in Hebrew, but I appreciate your advice here.
Why say why not?
Okay. I have this thing about, if you don't know Hebrew, don't get a Hebrew tattoo.
I will know that it says, let there be light.
But just get it in English.
That's boring.
Okay, and also, I've seen so many bad Hebrew tattoos.
Like backwards?
There's a girl in a local establishment.
Going with him.
There's a girl in a local establishment who has a text on her back shoulder blade. And I know this because the establishment allows their employees to wear tank tops. And for weeks, I was like staring at it, thinking like, I have no idea what this is. And then it hit me, oh, it's upside down and backwards. Oh. And it's upside down and backwards, Maranatha.
Oh.
Excellent. She didn't know Hebrew, nor does the tattoo artist. I did not, Laura. I did not tell her. I let it ride because somebody's probably told her and she doesn't need to hear it again from me.
I bet she doesn't know.
But
it reads right to left.
Yes. And upside down.
Yeah, so it was like I can't present this for the podcasting right audience.
Just
but it
imagine
was like this
Josh
and like
holding his fingers
going like
and
that,
turning them upside
that's
down.
Awful.
There you go.
Yeah. So
I bet she doesn't know.
But that's okay. It
who
has
does
meaning
she know
it has meaning to her.
Hebrew.
That's what the tattoo should have.
Yeah, I'm all about tattoos. I also get this a lot from former students. They'll text me and say, "Hey, what's this word in Hebrew?" I'm like, "Well, that's not even a word that's in Hebrew." Mm-hmm. And if it is, like, who cares? Just get it in English. I just don't.
So my thing is that phrase as it's written.
But, okay.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
In the Hebrew.
There you go.
But
I'm saying
I appreciate
this, side note, I'm saying this very loudly as I look past Chris's shoulder into the room where Tessa McKay Stoltz sits with an Aramaic tattoo emblazoned on her right wrist.
And it's beautiful, Tessa.
It's at least written in English, though. Like, she can read it.
She'd know what it meant.
And she knows what it means because it's in the New Testament story. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah. Rabbit trail.
There we go, rabbit trail. That was for free for all you listeners out there. Anything else here that sticks out to you? I think it's really important. And I struggle so much with this because for a normal human who just wants to read their Bible, getting this sort of depth is probably difficult. Which is why I would say do your best to find a halfway decent ecumenical academic study Bible, because the notes will unpack most of this stuff for you, and it can open up a whole new avenue to understanding the Bible, but it will cost you a bit of time, bit of work, bit of thoughtfulness, and folks don't always want to put that in to their Bible reading, which I guess I understand, but there's also a part of me that thinks, if we think that this book is the very word of God, wouldn't you want to try?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yes. But
thank you. Yes.
I would say that sometimes all we might have capacity for is simply reading this passage and appreciating that light can come out of the darkness, and the chaos, there's hope for the chaos. And that may be as far as we can or need to go. And so I guess what I'm getting at there is there's some value in being able to just read that into this passage and not have to have it be a literal scientific explanation of the emergence of the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. I need to hear that stuff because sometimes, you know, like I was saying earlier about how I want to create space for people to not think like I do or whatever. But then there's the part of me that rages when.
But there's so much you're missing.
Yeah, so there is so much that we are all collectively missing. Yeah. I don't know Akkadian. I've never read Enuma Elish in its original language. I'm sure there's nuances there that I'm missing. I'm not the greatest Hebrew reader of all time. I'm a 21st century American who grew up in Delaware. Like there's things from the culture that I'm not seeing, that I can't see, that any commentator, scholar, whoever is not privy to. So there's going to be things that we miss. I just know that personally, I have gained so much from trying and from reading and from hearing from folks that have dedicated their entire lives to unpacking these old dead languages and old dead cultures to see how new meaning might be apparent, new theological purpose. And even like going back to the Christian high school, for a kid that's sitting there in the room, who gives a crap that God created the world? How about we talk about their darkness and the light that's beaming into it? You know what I mean? Sometimes I just feel like we major on the minors and we focus, especially with kids and their education, we focus on things that probably doesn't really matter to them when we could give them something much more theologically potent. And that oftentimes comes from a reading of the text that isn't so focused on making it be historical.
Yeah. 100%.
So the reason why we're talking about this, and again, your kids aren't going to hear this, but for any parents in the listening space here, I know, or at least I assume, that your kids have probably asked about creation, about God, about this world, that sort of stuff. In your minds, what are some important takeaways from a Genesis 1 text for your little ones?
Well, what I've told my kids is that, you know, the central theme here is that God created.
Which, pause, in the ancient world, that's a big claim, right? Because it's different. The other stories, Enuma Elish, for example, creates a story of how the gods were created. There is no story of God being created. God just is. And when God began to create, there's no backstory. Right. It just launches in with Elohim doing Elohim-like things, which is cool. Go ahead.
It is. It's sort of BA.
Yes.
Yeah. And I love that. But, you know, there's a lot, and Chris sort of hit on this earlier, there's a lot that our finite brains can't cope with. So for us, everything has a beginning. And even if we don't know the end, we know there will be an end. And so when you think of God's around and then at one point he just started creating, you go down this black hole of, well, where did God come from? He just is. And that's cool. But anyway, what I tell my kids is God created, and I don't have all the specific scientific answers of how God did that. But the beauty part is that God did. He tamed, he ordered, and he did it for you. And it's awesome.
Chris, you have things to add to that?
I think the affirmation that we do every Sunday that, you know, for the kids, that this same creator of this thing that we can't wrap our heads around completely, we don't say that, but, you know, is your creator too and loves you. I think that would be a big takeaway for me. I would want to lean into those elements of the big, powerful God that cares about you, and cares about his creation here without bringing any baggage into what that means.
I think we do such a terrible job of celebrating the vastness of the universe. You know what I mean? Like, that's just not something that we talk about very often, and there might be some benefits there. With my kids, like, I'm coming into those conversations with years of study and foreign languages and ridiculousness that not a lot of people have. But one of my favorite things to do with them is to always turn their questions back and hear what they have to say. Dad, who created God? I don't know, buddy. What do you think? And then just let them go.
There's so much freedom as a parent in saying, I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? It's honest. I don't know.
And I think it sets a good table for them to know that there is no bad question.
Yeah.
Like there is no Pangea awaiting that, right? I'm going to strike it down, you know?
Yeah.
Like allowing them space. And not every parent can go there, because for some parents, there might be things that they're unwilling to compromise on. But I've found, at least up to this point in my life, allowing kids freedom and space to know that they are loved and cared for regardless of the answers that they have or the questions that they pose. And when we're talking about something as big as creation, to say, I don't know, buddy, I'm not a scientist, but here's what some smart people think. I don't know if they're right. You know, just trying to allow that to go. And I also do absolutely nerd out with them. My kids absolutely have heard about Marduk and Tiamat. That's and cool. Her being filleted and him creating an expanse. And look, buddy, here's an expanse in our Bible too. And look, these ancient people, they were kind of breathing the same air, talking about things in the same ways. Isn't that really awesome? These books are different, but they are written for different people for different purposes, and they say different things about their God. Isn't that neat? And hopefully that'll pay some dividends in, at some point in their lives as they wrestle with big questions. So parents, know that you're not alone and that you're allowed to say you don't know. And sometimes just asking the question back allows your kids to go off. And that can be a really beautiful thing and a way for you to understand where they're coming from. Final thoughts from the crew? I take that as a no.
I'm glad we got to solve this today. Yeah. and we came together with all of the answers to every question. And we're done.
There you go. Yeah. So we don't even have to talk about it on Sunday. Yeah.
We didn't even charge for this.
No, just listen to it. All right, folks. Next time we get together, we will be talking about Samuel, which isn't necessarily in my wheelhouse, but...
It's interesting.
It's interesting, and we'll have fun doing it. So until then, see y'all.
Bye.
Bye.